March the 26th, 1994. This is the House State Affairs Committee convened in Juneau. Representative Al Veazey presiding. President, Representative Pete Cott, Representative Gary Davis, and Representative Betty Davis. And Representative Jerry Sanders, are you with us in Anchorage?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Davis, I'm sorry, Representative Sanders, we will be taking public testimony when we get to House Bill 480. I do not at this time anticipate taking public testimony on the other items on our agenda, and we will go through those first, and then we'll go into public testimony on 480. Does that sound like a suitable plan for you?
That's just fine with me. I understood it was going to be around 9 o'clock. I just want to be here for the whole meeting.
Okay. First item on our agenda this morning is House Joint Resolution number 62, urging the Congress to reevaluate its practice of imposing unfunded mandates on state and local governments. Is there any debate on this measure?
Hearing Chairman, I think it's a good idea.
Hearing no
unfortunately,
debate.
Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to do much to facilitate some cooperation at that level, but anything, I guess, is better than nothing.
Is there further debate? Hearing none, what is the wish of the committee?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Davis.
I move House Joint Resolution 62 out of State Affairs with individual recommendation.
Would the committee
Zero
secretary please call the roll?
Representative Al Veazey?
Yes.
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 Mr. Chairman, I do have Representative Sanders' proxy, if you want to care to include it for the record.
No, but Representative Sanders, though you cannot technically vote for the record, you may state your position on this issue if you wish.
Yes.
Appreciate his brevity.
What part of yes don't we understand? The next item on our agenda is House Bill 523, an act amending Alaska Rule of Criminal Procedure relating to admissibility of hearsay evidence by peace officers before the grand jury. This bill is amending existing statutes, and the first section is a finding and purpose of the reason of the act. The second section is amend some of the existing wording under Alaska Rule of Criminal Procedure. This act does amend a court rule and therefore would require a two-thirds vote in order of both houses in order to become effective. I didn't even look to see if we have any person signed in. I don't see any persons here to testify on this bill. Is there any debate or any questions? Representative Sanders, of course, you know you're welcome to join us in debate or asking questions. Do you have the bill before you, Representative Sanders? Okay, this bill merely revises the court rules of evidence to allow a supervising police officer to relate the testimony of another peace officer. The intent is to reduce the amount of time that police officers have to spend in court as opposed to being out on the street on duty. Hearing no debate, what is the pleasure of the committee? Representative Gary Davis.
Mr. Chairman, I move we move House Bill 523 from State Affairs to Judiciary, individual recommendations, accompanying fiscal notes.
Would the committee secretary please call the roll?
Representative Al Veazey?
Yes.
Representative Pete?
Yes.
Representative Fran Ulmer? Representative Betty Davis?
Yes.
Representative Gary Davis?
Yes.
Representative Carly Over?
Okay. And House Bill 523 has passed from the House State Affairs Committee with individual recommendations. and a zero fiscal note. I really would think that they should have had a negative fiscal note, but that's okay.
Haven't seen many of them.
No, you don't see too many of those. The next item on our agenda is House Bill 353. It is an act regarding the accounting records of condominium associations. We have with us Representative Jeanette James, the sponsor of the bill. She was here a moment ago. Let's take a brief at ease while we Ms. James stepped up to her office, and we'll be right back. Before we get the sponsor statement, I would point out that we have before us Labor and Commerce Committee substitute for House Bill number 353, and I would bring to the attention of the committee House Bill number 353. It is my opinion that both bills accomplish the same thing, and I think this committee can look at both bills and decide which one they think would be the more appropriate, if either, to take action on. And Representative James has joined us. Representative James, we've introduced your bill. I have pointed out to the committee that we have a committee substitute for us, as well as the original bill is in our packet. The bill that has been transmitted to the committee is committee substitute for House Bill number 353 by Labor and Commerce. Would you please care to make a statement?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill started out being a really simple bill. Basically, what it was is that when they redid the regulations and changed the condominium regulations in 1986, I believe it was, they didn't require any longer an audit of the condo association. But because they had previously to that time, there was an audit required for condo associations each year by a CPA. That let there be two different rules for condos. The biggest problem that the people were having with this, it was a very expensive for no purpose. And so what the purpose of the bill was is to not require a condominium associations to have an annual audit. And it was amended in Labor and Commerce because they pointed out that maybe the best thing to do would be to make the two requirements for both of the bookkeeping and so forth of a condo association to be the same for those before 1987 and those after 1987, and that seemed to be a rational approach. There was still some opposition about that, but the position that myself as a sponsor of this bill is that the condo associations can still have an audit if the condo associations wish to do that and put it in their bylaws or their regulations for their own protection. If the financing organization or the finance person wants to require an audit, they can do that as a part of the financing. And I didn't believe that it was us, the state, that should make a requirement that condo associations have an annual audit. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And do you feel the committee substitute is a better version of the statute than is the original bill?
I was completely happy with the original bill to just exclude the audit in the original statute. I don't have any real problem with adding all of these accounting requirements for the older associations. I see no need for it, but I don't have any problem with it. I was happy with my original bill, and I'm not really all that unhappy with
What does a committee substitute accomplish, in your opinion?
There's a list of requirements that identify the kind of accounting that is required in the. It's actually. Let me see just quickly what the number of that is, if I have it right here. It's. 490. The requirements that's in 490 were the association records. Those only apply, those association records only applied to the condos that were built after 1987. And this committee substitute then, rather than just excluding out of 3407-280 that all books and records shall be kept in accordance with good accounting procedures, shall be audited at least once a year by an outside auditor outside of the organization, just that change was my original bill, then what they did is they tied in to that requirement that they do the record keeping that is outlined in 490, which is more extensive, tells all the different kinds of records that you have to keep and outlines the kinds of records that they should have regarding information for the sales of the condos and that sort of thing. So, you know, it's not a bad committee substitute. I don't know that it was necessary, but I don't see that it causes any trauma.
Well, we'll take a brief at ease here. King, Representative James, I was listening to your testimony, but I still am not sure what the Labor and Commerce Committee thought they were accomplishing by making this change. The only change you were proposing in the statute was in 3407-280B. You simply deleted one sentence.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. And actually what they were doing is getting a feel-good amendment. And there was opposition in the Labor and Commerce Committee regarding some people who managed condos and who really wanted to be sure that there was a requirement for an annual audit. And so they didn't want to take that. They didn't want to take that out. And they decided that, well, if they tighten it up a little bit and make the bookkeeping requirements and so forth tie into what the law was effective in starting in 1987, that they'd feel a little bit more comfortable that there was at least some rules as to how the bookkeeping should be done. If we didn't do that, then those bookkeeping records that are in 490 only apply to those condos that were after 1987.
If you wanted to say that both of the copies are down on the floor, it'd be a few minutes.
Well, I guess I still, perhaps I don't understand the statute well enough, but what the committee substitute appears to me to be doing is merely going into more detail to say the same thing.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, and that's exactly what they're doing. It's just that they're putting some, they're making them feel good because instead of just saying that these condos don't have to have an audit, it doesn't for those condo associations that were formed before 1987 don't have any rules whatsoever in the statutes regarding to the bookkeeping and accounting methods that would be taken in a condo association. My personal feeling about that is that's okay. Because I think that the condo association will determine what needs. The financing, the financial institution will require what it needs, and that we as a state don't need to require what they need. But there is a provision of what kinds of steps and what kinds of information must be provided in the statute for those condos that were formed after 1987.
It was 87 or 85?
I was thinking it was 87, but it was...
86, wasn't it?
Probably.
Well, the date is irrelevant, but there's two levels of rules, and so
those condominium associations formed prior to these sections were enacted. The session laws of Alaska 85 became effective in 86, I believe.
Right. Okay.
Prior to that, there were no rules. They just whatever the commercial market required, they did.
As I understand it, I didn't look at that whole statute. I was of the assumption that they made some changes and maybe might have taken some of those out and replaced them with these new ones. I'm not sure because I didn't read the entire old statute.
Doesn't matter.
But they didn't take out the part that made those associations require them to have an audit each year.
No, they were they were not required to have an audit prior to 1987, 85, somewhere in that area.
They were.
They were.
Prior to, but not after.
After they were not.
Yeah, right. Before they were and after they were not. So we have two different classes of people. Those who had a condo that was before this new date and those after. Those before had to have an audit. Those after did not. And so my bill would just make a level playing field between the two. But their fear was in Labor and Commerce that if we take that out, then there's no specifics whatsoever for those prior to 1986, whatever date was, as to how they must keep their records.
Okay,
and so they wanted to tie those newer records back into everybody.
You're right. The requirement for an audit goes back to 1963.
Mm-hmm.
Annual audit?
An annual audit. That requirement goes back to 63. And then it's... in the session laws of Alaska of 1985, that we... required slightly different standard. I'm not quite sure. The problem that I have is it appears that in the committee substitute 3408490 and 3408590, doing a cursory review, I haven't thoroughly reviewed them, it appears to be really addressing the resale of a condominium.
That's correct.
And I fail to see what that has to do with the association accounting standards, other than the fact that when you get into a resale.
Well, and that's true, but that it, in other words, what I understand that it's saying is that the records that are kept on these condominiums must be available to get this information if a resale were to occur. And so it does in a sense say how the records should be kept so that information is readily available. I suppose that information could be gone back and gotten if the resale was coming, but that it sort of outlines the records that need to be kept.
It appears that the requirement under a resale for a financial statement is subsection 6, which says the most recent regularly prepared balance sheet and income and expense statement, if any, of the association.
It's pretty loose.
Pretty loose. What would your recommendation to this committee be?
If I had my druthers, I'd rather have my original bill.
And the debate in Labor and Commerce Committee was?
It was centered on fears of two people, I believe, testified. Fears that the condo associations would be not behaving properly with the money and condo owners would be ripped off at the will of the condo association and that we need to protect them in some way from that happening. And my opinion is that they have a right to require these things in their bylaws and be sure that they're done. And not only do they have a right, but they have a responsibility, if it's a condo association of which they are part, to be sure that that condo association is doing things properly. The other testimony that they had in Labor and Commerce was that a real estate person who had taken over the management of some condos and the records were in bad shape. And so she had said, well, she needed an audit before she took over, and that's the standard procedure. That's exactly what, if someone else comes and takes over someone's records, you require an audit. But that's not something I don't think we have to put in state statute.
Well, I happen to, personally, it's my opinion that the statement that all books and records shall be kept in accordance with good accounting procedures is a pretty strong statement.
I agree.
Further debate? Representative Gary Davis.
I'm going to make sure I have this straight here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So prior to 86, we'll say 86, an annual audit was required. Then there was some changes in statute where associations after 86 did not require an annual audit. And your original bill makes it a level playing field where there are no annual audits required by anyone.
That's correct.
Okay. Just the standard accounting procedures.
Procedures, right.
Okay. If I might, Mr. Chairman, continue, do you happen to know what the rationale was in 86 for the change?
I can't respond to that. There was a totally new rewrite of the whole condo methods of handling property, and it had to do with more of a property change than it is, and I'm not real familiar with that.
Mr. Chairman, I tend to agree that just the statement that comply with standard accounting procedures should satisfy any prudent property owner or association member.
Apologize for the delay. The first four copiers are broken.
If the committee would like, we could find copies of the session laws of Alaska of 1985 and dig into what the thought process was. It does appear from reading the legislation that the intent of the 1985 laws was to define a little more clearly what the requirements for the resale of a condominium were, and to relax the accounting standards to a level that would meet those requirements and not necessarily anything higher than that. That would eliminate the requirement for an audit. And there was enacted a series of requirements for reselling a condominium. Those are still in effect. And they became effective January 1, 1986, which is the cutoff date that Representative James was referring to.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Gary Davis.
Question on what was just handed us. These are current statutes? No, pre-86.
Yes.
Okay, no, this one's... Okay, pre-86 on top here. So this is... Okay.
Chairman, I might say that, you know, the protection is actually in 3407-290.
Yes, that is the statute that we are, I'm sorry, we're looking at 280.
But even 290, the protection for the apartment owners, is pretty well outlined in that section, that they are able to examine the books and look at the receipts and expenditures and...
Yes, all that this, your original bill does to me is simply eliminates the standard for an audit, that a financial review, or if the owners of the association are satisfied, a compilation is sufficient. And it's really up to the owners, because the condominium association has to comply with the bylaws, which in turn have to be approved by any financing institution. Again, I would just state that I think that the wording, all books and records shall be kept in accordance with good accounting procedures, is pretty strong wording.
Mr. Chairman, is that speaking from an accountant's point of view?
No, sir, I am not an accountant. However, as a business manager and organization manager and officer of various organizations, is speaking from experience of having to review financial accounting balance sheets.
Is the term good accounting procedures acceptable term among the accounting community?
It is. If I was going to use the word, I would use the phrasing in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles, but I believe the terminology is interchangeable. Good accounting procedures would be something that a court would rely on a certified public accountant to give expert testimony on to whether or not it would work.
So, Mr. Chairman, the original bill eliminates the requirement for an annual audit. That's correct?
That's correct.
And the committee substitute does that, as well as a couple other things, at least according to the memorandum from Jeff Chenoweth, the drafting attorney. I'm still trying to clarify my own mind.
Here's a session one.
I don't really think the committee's curiosity is enough that we want to dig into the session laws of 85, but...
Mr. Chairman, Representative James, have you taken a look at the position of the drafting attorney on his memorandum?
I don't believe I have that.
It's the last two pages, very short. What he's trying to do here looks like it's, as well, level the playing field. He uses that terminology in a couple of areas. Page 3 of his memo, midway down, is what starts the draft committee substitute and makes changes only to S-3407-280B. One, eliminates the requirement for an annual audit, which the original bill did. Two, it substitutes a directive that for the purpose of keeping financial records, the Association of Apartment Owners, he's using the same language as in 3407. So the Association of Apartment Owners is subject to 3408, the performance standard would be same as set out 3408. A lot of legalese there. That things a little bit. So I guess what I'm saying is that the committee substitute does what you intended, plus more.
Mr. Chairman, I might point out that this memorandum is in support of the first committee substitute draft by Labor and Commerce, which still required some audits at intervals of at least every third to fifth year, which is E, which is probably in your packet. And I don't have I don't believe it refers to the J one that you have in your packet.
On the subject of the memorandum, it does refer to draft work order 8, LS-1474J.
It does have J on it as well.
I assume that's in reference to the committee substitute bill.
Okay. You're right. Mr. Chairman, the concern that they had in Labor and Commerce was they didn't want to just wipe this out, and it was kind of a compromise effort.
I kind of gather it was a compromise effort, but personally, I'm kind of reluctant to go with the Labor and Commerce version. Quite frankly, because I believe somebody's attempting here to leave it vague enough that a person could take the position that an audit is required. I think the original bill is much more clear. The committee substitute is vague. What is required to meet 3408-490, which references you back to 590. Um, And I believe what this is saying is that it's going to be the status quo, or could be interpreted that way, that if you have an association that was formed prior to January 1, 1986, you can keep records. Keep accurate records. It doesn't say good accounting procedures, it just says accurate records. Which I think is a slightly different statement, though not a bad statement. It does say that audits would be allowed. I think that's superfluous. Of course, an organization can have an audit if they want. It goes on. The opening part just says that it's cautioning them that your records keeping must comply with, in essence, 3408590A6 specifically, which says records, if any. Is there further debate? What is the pleasure of the committee? Gary Davis.
Mr. Chairman, I think we should be dealing with the original. As indicated, I think it makes it's a lot more clear. The labor and commerce, I think, is complicating the issue a little bit more than the original, and simplicity is certainly needed these days.
Representative Davis, I'll take that as a motion that we adopt the original House bill.
Yes.
And never having gone backwards before, I see no reason why we can't do that. We would simply recommend that the House adopt House Bill number 3853.
Reference to A.
Pardon?
A.
LSA 1474/A.
No, I have no. The wording I said, I'm sure, is very adequate. We're just not adopting the committee substitute. We're adopting. We're passing the original bill. It is version A. Happens to be version A. Is there any objection to the motion to adopt the original bill?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to object. I prefer the committee substitute bill.
Would the
I guess the question I have is how many votes do we need to adopt?
I require 4 votes to move a bill out of committee. Everything else is a majority of the quorum present. Would the committee secretary call the roll?
Representative Albizzi?
Yes.
Representative Peacock?
No.
Representative Crane Olmer? Representative Betty Davis?
Yes.
Representative Gary Davis?
Yes.
Representative Sanders, do you wish to express an opinion on this action?
Yeah, I'll say yes.
Okay, we have before us a House Bill number 353. What's the pleasure of the committee? Representative Gary Davis?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we pass out of committee House Bill number 353. Individual recommendations accompanying fiscal notes.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Would the committee secretary please call the roll?
Representative Albizzi?
Yes.
Representative
Peacock?
No.
Representative Crane Olmer? Representative Betty Davis?
Yes.
Representative Gary Davis?
Yes.
Representative Harley Ober?
Okay, and
Chairman,
the
I'm changing my vote from
A to A. Thank you, Representative Cott. Let the record show that Representative Cott has changed his vote from A to A. And so House Bill 353 has passed from the State Affairs Committee.
Thank you very much.
Now I've got to have to make a notation on this report somehow. And quite frankly, I'm not sure how to do it. The next item on our agenda, and I'm sorry, we've already taken action on HB 523. We have Mr. Guanelli with the Department of Law here. Did you wish to testify on 353? We passed it out of committee. I think prior to your coming into the room. But I didn't see you sneak in. But were you here when we passed it out of the
room? I was not.
Okay.
I heard it was coming up fourth or fifth.
You snooze, you lose around here. You got to move.
Thank you.
Senate Joint Resolution number 46, waiving the IRS diesel fuel die rule. This is a Senate Joint Resolution sponsored by Senator Halford. Is there a representative from Senator Halford's office here today? Would you care to give us a sponsor statement? Mr. Dave Thompson with Senator Halford's office is here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. The Senator appreciates the opportunity to have this legislation heard. It's pretty straightforward. The IRS has passed this, it was part of the Ombudsman Reconciliation Act of 1993. But in Alaska, the effect is that 95% of the diesel fuel sold in this state has to have dye added to it. There's been an ongoing controversy because originally they wanted blue dye put in it. The problem with that was that it looks a lot like Avgas 100, which is a very popular aviation fuel, so the FAA had a problem with that. They then switched to red dye, only to find the same problem. SJR 46 is not contingent.
Would you clarify what the red dye
does? It adds it to the fuel, but again, there's another Avgas that has red dye in it already.
Which is your 130, 110, 8087?
Right. And so, however that's resolved, it doesn't slow up SJR 46 because what this asks for is a waiver of the entire practice in the state of Alaska for two main reasons. One, the FAA concerns for safety. The small planes in this state are, I believe, the largest of anywhere in the country, so that's a significant concern. And the other is that the logistics in rural areas make it very difficult to put dye in diesel fuel, no matter what the purpose. So those that sell diesel fuel in this state have asked for this resolution and are pursuing a waiver on the federal level. And there's at least three federal agencies involved, as well as our own comparable state agencies, in trying to get this accomplished. And all this does is express the support of the legislature in support of pursuing that waiver.
Now, we cannot address the title of a Senate joint resolution in the House, but to me, it's improper that we're referring to this as non-taxable diesel fuel, and it may not be totally erroneous, but diesel fuel by its nature is a motor fuel and is taxable. What is not taxable is heating fuel. That's just the vernacular that I'm familiar with. Was there any discussion on that? I mean, I think we understand what the intent is here, but non-taxable diesel fuel would not mean the same to me as non-taxable heating fuel. Fuel for a used to be the fuel for a compressor or a generator is not taxable, but of course now it is subject to some taxes.
Well, I don't know, Representative. I'll look into that. These things, of course, are drafted by Ledge Affairs. My question had to come up on the Senate side. So.
Okay. Well, I don't believe there is a legal definition of diesel. I think it's just a common usage differentiation. Point being, if you want to pay taxes and buy a petroleum distillate with a flash point of somewhere around 100, you ask for diesel fuel, and if you want to use it for non-taxable purposes, you ask for heating oil. It's just kind of customary. Representative Gary Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In speaking to your concern about non-taxable diesel fuel, the first whereas indicates that the act requiring dyes indicates that effective January 1st, 1999, requires dyeing of diesel fuel that is exempt from federal diesel fuel tax. So apparently my reading of that is that the requiring die-in is only required for non-taxable diesel fuel, apparently.
Representative David, I could be entirely wrong, and this wording may have come right out of federal regulations. It's just a question of usage, I guess. I don't really have any serious problem. It just something jumps out at me. Maybe I pay too much taxes on diesel fuel over the years. I don't know.
Make it all.
Further debate. Mr. Thompson, thank you for being with us. Appreciate you waiting patiently. What is the pleasure of the committee? Representative Cott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we move CS for Senate Joint Resolution number 46, State Affairs, out of State Affairs, House side, within his recommendations.
And the attached general fiscal note. Would the committee secretary please call the roll?
Representative Albee.
Yes.
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 And Senate Joint Resolution number 46 is passed in the House State Affairs Committee with individual recommendations. The next item on our agenda is House Bill 480. I'd like to take a 8-minute recess, and we'll reconvene at 9 o'clock. Next item on our agenda is House Bill 480, driver's license requirements. It's got about a half a page title. I won't read it. I will simply turn the floor over to Representative Sanders and let him give us a sponsor statement and explain this 6-page bill to us.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, everybody. The Brady bill, which passed in November 93, sets up a background check that identifies felons and persons adjudicated mentally incompetent. It also mandates a 5-day waiting period before purchasing a handgun unless the purchase has been pre-approved. 480 requires the Department of Public Safety to issue driver's license and ID cards with a magnetic strip encoded with criminal information on the license of felons and those adjudicated mentally ill. This data would be encoded on the back of the criminal's license in a way that would only allow the police and gun dealers to know the person's status. Gun dealers would use a special card reader, similar to a credit card reader, that would show a green light to indicate approval or a red light to indicate that they were prohibited from having a gun. Upon becoming a prohibited person, a person's license is void and seized by the trial court. When a prohibited person becomes eligible to obtain a new driver's license, they shall pay additional fees to cover the records check and the encoding of the required information on the new license. Once this system is in place and everyone has their new licenses, the city police will be relieved of the extra time-consuming burden of having to perform a complete records check every time an ordinary citizen wants to buy a gun. Right now, people all over the country are very confused about how this Brady bill is going to be enforced. And to my knowledge, I don't believe it's being enforced today. I think they're just taking the paperwork and holding it 5 days. And this leaves them with the paperwork. The Brady bill sets up a background check system which could easily lead to gun owner registration. That's the part that worries me quite a bit. It's true that Brady mandates that these records and background checks are to be destroyed. But there's no penalties established to punish officials who violate that law. Thus, what guarantees are there that officials will not disregard the law? Several cities, Cleveland, New York City, and Chicago among them, have banned guns.
Representative Sanders?
Yes.
Could I? Okay, please continue. I apologize for interrupting.
Like I say, several cities, like Cleveland, New York, and Chicago, are just as three examples, have banned the very guns which were once legally registered with the police. In New York City, the police have even enforced the gun ban by confiscating the firearms of honest citizens once they were on the list. Clearly, once registration laws are in place, officials can easily enforce a ban since they know where the guns are. And in San Jose, California, we had an instance where a former chief of 1984 that I've made it considerably tougher for residents to get a handgun. As long as this is in the hands of individuals, many of us down there have seen what's happened to a lot of our gun laws that we've tried to put through this time. And is there any doubt that you're going to be dealing with the same individuals when you go to get your gun permit? Or go to buy your gun? I'll leave it at that and let people discuss it. There's a very large fiscal note under public safety, and I don't have it in my packet here, so I may have to have Bob address that. I think he's at the meeting down there, my aide. I'll just let it go with that.
Okay, thank you, Representative Sanders, and I appreciate your work on this bill. I'm somewhat of a simpleton. I've got one question for you, if I may. Still with us?
Yes.
Rather than going to a rather expensive magnetic code strip, why don't we just put a little red dot up in the left-hand corner of the driver's license? Or why don't we just change the steel of the state of Alaska and make it red instead of black if they're not eligible to own a pistol?
Well, Terry, that's a good question. I think that would be, this information on the magnetic code would be available only when you wanted to present it to a gun dealer or if you were picked up by a police officer. If you had it'd be kind of like the old scarlet letter.
Yep.
You had that on your driver's license. Available to everybody. And that's not a very well thought out answer, but that's my immediate response.
Well, the intent here is to get around the Brady Bill. Is that not correct?
Yes, sir.
I think what, you know, I just try to take a simplistic approach. I mean, we could just mandate that everybody have a red state of Alaska seal on driver's license unless they want to indicate they're eligible to own a handgun, in which case they could request a black one. And if they weren't a convicted felon, they could get one. I mean, there's a couple, you could approach it from the positive side or the negative side.
Now, when you look at it that way, it might work. I really hadn't thought about it.
Okay, well, I just wanted to throw that out because I sure always look for simple solutions if there is one. Representative Gary Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, your suggestion is, this is sound. I think Representative Sanders' response was to the point. However, it might, you know, a dot or something that is visible on anybody that saw your license or had access to your driver's license, what all it would be saying would be that you are eligible to own a handgun and not necessarily that you do. But I suppose someone that does go to that trouble would more than likely own one. So.
A variation of my comment would be that it could be a black dot that was either sensitive or non-sensitive to ultraviolet light. I mean, I personally, think that a red dot in the corner of a license plate, a license of a person that is not legally eligible to own a firearm is not an undue invasion of privacy. It might require a statutory change, but wouldn't be much of one. It's just a suggestion. Representative Sanders, do you have anything else to say, or should we go on to our witnesses?
Well, I'd be happy to listen to the testimony. I'd like to know what the people think about it.
Okay, well, we have Mr. Bert Maupin in Anchorage.
Yes, I am.
Mr. Maupin, please state your name, your address, and if you would, your phone number, and then give us your testimony.
Prescribed by the state.
Mr. Maupin, you're referring to House Bill 351, the bill regarding permits to carry concealed weapons, and the requirement for fingerprinting have been in that bill. They've been out of that bill. I think they're currently in that bill. The bill, I believe, does require certification of competency in the use of a handgun in order to get a permit to carry a concealable weapon. Anyway, that bill is not in this committee. The bill we're talking about is a bill by Representative Sanders, who I'm sure would be glad to spend as much time as you'd like to explain it to you. But his intent here is that there is ways of getting around the Brady Bill requirement that people register and go through a background check. And he is trying to come up with a statewide system that will accomplish this. And we're jumping through hoops to do what a lot of people, to protect what a lot of people think is basic constitutional rights. But nonetheless, we are faced with this federal intrusion, and we're looking for an answer.
How about nonviolent felons?
Are you talking again about HB 351? Due to time restraints, I'd really like to limit testimony to 480.
Okay. That's about it for me, then.
The current law on the ownership of concealable weapons is that a convicted felon cannot own a concealable weapon until that felon has been restored his full civil rights. Now, after that individual's full civil rights have been restored, they can again own a weapon. A concealable weapon.
Okay, well, that's about it for me then.
Okay, next I'd like to go to Bethel. We have a Mr. Vern Keyser with UWSA, and if you would, Mr. Keyser, give us your name, your address, and the organization that you're representing.
Yes, my name is Vernon Keyser, Sr. I'm representing myself and United We Stand America. My address is Post Office Box 242, Bethel, 99559, and my phone number is 543-2285.
Please give us your testimony.
Yes. One of the first problems with this is that this is not fiscally responsible. This is going to create a cost to the state at a time when we're cutting budgets on vital programs. Another problem with this is the fact that the Gun Control Act of 1968 covers most everything in here except this reader strip. So that's just duplication of laws already on the books. I heard a mention of the Brady Bill, and the Brady Bill in itself didn't meet the requirement that the NRA put out for instant background check. They want a check too. We want checks, but we want an instant check. The 5-day waiting period is a little ridiculous. The cost to the law enforcement agencies throughout the state, they've arbitrarily picked a figure of $10 or $20 or whatever. There's nothing in the bill that even allows anyone to charge for these checks. And the Brady Bill itself is so vague and unenforceable that the state of Arizona has filed a suit against the government. And I understand there are several law enforcement agencies, sheriff's departments, etc. throughout the country that have also filed suits. We'd like to urge our governor to file a suit for this state against that bill, because it's not a good bill. That's about really all I have to say about this thing. The cost prohibitive, ridiculous to even consider at a time like this. It's something that's vital to the health, safety, and welfare of the public right now. We've got a lot more challenging issues in health and the welfare of the people. That's about all I have here now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Keyser. Next, I'd like to go to Fairbanks. We have a Mr. Ladd McBride.
Yes,
Yes, we can hear you just fine.
Yeah, I'm Lance McBride. My mailing address is P.O. Box 83567, Fairbanks, Alaska, 99708. My phone number is 479-8096, and I'm representing myself. I'm not in favor of this either, except, but I would like to make a comment that you do not define on your definitions handgun, and I thought that felons were prohibited from owning any firearms, so I don't quite understand what's going on there, because you're specifically stating handguns throughout this whole bill. This is very much connected to the House Joint Resolution 62, which is urging Congress to reevaluate imposing unfunded mandates on state and local governments, and I think the Brady Law is a primary example of this. There's nothing stated in this bill as to the cost of implementation or maintenance of this potential law, and I classify this as an unfunded mandate. If I'm a good guy, why am I paying a fee to identify the bad guy? Who will be, and still related to the cost factor, who will be paying for all these code readers? Well, we all know what the answer to that one is. So what's next, fellas? Computer chips implanted in all of us and track our every move? This is somewhat of an odorous bill to law-abiding citizens. Why not hang a placard or tattoo the convicted felon or mental incompetent? Oops, sorry, did I say tattoo? Well, anyway, this bill smacks of additional gun control. In my opinion, not acceptable. I thank you, gentlemen.
Mr. McBride, could I ask now, is it just the magnetic strip that you're testifying against, or are you opposed to any kind of a identification that would indicate that a person is legally barred from owning a firearm?
I think that person that is legally identified as being barred from owning a firearm, as you put it.
I'm sorry, not a firearm. We're talking about a concealable weapon.
Well, how do you know that you're buying a handgun to be concealed? I guess there's a little problem with terms there. I think the person that is not eligible to buy or conceal a firearm or carry or what have you should be identified. But I don't think the law-abiding citizen should be drawn into this because of not only the invasion of privacy, but also the addition of costs involved. Does that answer your question?
I believe so. That you would not be opposed then to, say, a convicted felon who did not have his civil rights restored having, say, a red dot on the left-hand side of his driver's license.
Or some such. Perhaps the magnetic strip is not always apparent to casual observers. His could possibly be coded to the effect that he is not eligible to purchase concealed carry or what have you, handguns or firearms, or purchase them.
Okay, well, thank you for your testimony, Mr. McBride.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in Fairbanks, Mr. McBride? You're the only one I have on my list.
To my knowledge, I'm in.
Okay. Next, I'd like to go to Glenn Allen, Mr. Paul Weir.
Yes, my name is Paul Weir, Box 275, Glenn Allen, 822-3902 is phone number. I'm representing myself only. I object to the bill in the first four lines. It says they're going to issue driver's license and identification cards with a magnetic strip. We don't need any more magnetic strips implanted in our forehead. I agree mostly with what Mr. McBride said. Fairbanks. I wouldn't object to, say, a red dot on it if you're putting a red dot only on a felon, not on bona fide, legitimate, law-abiding citizens. And I think probably this law is uncalled for and would be a waste of time.
Thank you, Mr. Weir. Does that conclude your testimony? Thank you very much. And so next, I'd like to go to Toke. We have a Mr. McLaughlin.
Yes. Can you hear me fine?
Yes, we can.
Yes, Bruce McLaughlin, Box 71, Toke. First of all, most criminals will not try to purchase a handgun through legal means anyway, knowing full well that they will not
you, sir. I would point out that while we all recognize it's a well-established fact that criminals do not purchase their guns through dealers as a rule, the Brady Bill assumes that they do and is imposing a tremendous inconvenience and disparity upon law-abiding citizens. The intent of the bill here is that the magnetic strip that is being referred to here would not, if a person is not a convicted felon, you know, the strip would not reveal any information. So it's not trying to get information on law-abiding citizens. It's trying to come up with a way that would satisfy a federal requirement that felons be identified and prohibited from purchasing guns. But I couldn't agree with you more that criminals simply don't go to the store and buy guns. They break into your house and steal them. That is all the persons I have signed up to testify. Are there additional persons with us by teleconference?
Well, Donna is online, and we have one testifier.
Okay, I don't know how I slipped over you, but I did. Thank you. Please, if you would, I don't have a name in front of me, so...
My name is Robert Wiseman. My address, mailing address, is P.O. Box 1135 in Soldotna. My physical address is 36340 Wren in the Kenai South Voting District. Gentlemen, one of the things I think might have been overlooked here is that Brady requires 4 years from now that every state be in compliance with the national records check system, so I think we have to consider the fact that we're going to have to do something just to comply with that part of Brady. I'm not sure that the little red dot in the corner of the driver's license does comply with that. Unlike some of the other folks, I'm very disappointed that as an upright and law-abiding citizen that I have to continually prove this to someone when the criminal seems to gain more and more rights every day. I've kind of prepared a little written. I'd like to get into it so I don't lose up all my 3 minutes.
Mr. Wiseman?
The legislature have found that most Alaskans think that we have to get something out of this session that will not only exempt Alaskans from the current effects and the cost of processing all of these forms that Brady has required.
Okay, Mr. Wiseman?
Yes.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but I have not been holding anybody to a time this morning. We have sufficient time to hear those witnesses that have come before us, and most people have been very considerate and have stated their point and been brief. If you need more than 3 minutes, I'll be glad to give you more.
Thank you, sir. To continue, though, again, we must be in compliance with all the mandates of Brady, which does require this instant check system be implemented 4 years down the road. Again, I have to repeat, I think it's real necessary that we have action out of this session so that we send a clear message to Washington, D.C. that Alaskans are serious about the right to own firearms, but also to support our own Senator Stevens, who has been very staunch in the support of these rights, quite outspoken and vocal in Congress for us. And so we need to let him know that we agree with him and appreciate that stance he's taken. That Alaskans are also very serious about the Second Amendment rights that our founding fathers felt so adamant about that they made it the Second Amendment to the Constitution. And they did this to guarantee that we as a people will never be subjected to oppression and tyranny. That oppression and tyranny may not always come from a foreign country, but from within our own country or our government, or quite often anymore, it seems like our neighbors. The court system has seen fit to pamper felons and turn them back out into the public. So my need to be able to ensure my protection and protect my family and my property seems to be more adamant all the time. Yet Brady Bill wants to be a forerunner to stronger legislation that would deny that right. I think that by passing some legislation now, we'll send that message that we Alaskans feel strongly about it. I do also think that whatever legislation is passed must have a zero budget effect. After the initial implementation, which again is mostly required by Brady, from that time on, the maintenance of the system must be paid for.
Thank you, Mr. Wiseman. Are there questions from the committee?
Chairman?
Representative Sanders.
Yes, Representative Sanders here at Anchorage. I would just like to associate myself with the remarks of the previous speaker. I think he has the right idea there for what I'm trying to accomplish. And for the speaker previous to that, I'd just like to, if I could, read a little part of the Brady Bill. He had said that the law enforcement officers should be responsible and that we should be able to come back on them if they don't operate this the way it's supposed to be done. In the Brady Bill, it says a law enforcement officer or other person responsible for providing criminal history background information pursuant to this subsection shall not be liable in an action at law for damages for preventing such a sale or transfer to a person who may lawfully receive or possess a handgun. This means that any official that willfully denies law-abiding citizens their right to buy a handgun can do so with impunity, and the individual has no recourse under federal law. I'd just like to point that out.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. I have not read the Brady Bill. I was not aware of that, but it sounds like we've just passed a federal law that gives public officials carte blanche authority to deny individuals the right to own firearms.
That's true.
Representative Sanders, do you have any other, would you like to make a closing comment other than that, or?
Oh, I think that was the closing comment.
Okay. Representative Gary Davis.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Sanders, you indicated you're expecting a fiscal note from probably DMV. Is that, or public safety? Which one's that?
Representative Davis, I believe it's in the packet. I believe it's in your packet. I just didn't have it in mine. Packet. I brought the
Anchorage
with me.
We have Department of Law, and that's the only one. That's a zero one, Jerry.
Oh, can you check with Bob there?
I just did, and he indicates he hasn't received any this morning. Did you hear any numbers on the rumors?
Well, I saw it. Again, ask Bob if he's
in that way. I objected to their original figures, so they're reading.
Please, order in the committee room here. We are on the record. If we want to do some housekeeping measures, we can go off the record. We have before us Representative Sanders. If you would like, we can wait. Hold off on any committee action until we do receive a fiscal note. It certainly is germane. Whatever the pleasure of the committee is, we could move it off with the fiscal note we have, I suppose, technically. I don't like to do that, knowing that the agency that is the most fiscally impacted has not turned in a fiscal note yet.
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that it would probably be the proper thing to do to hold it until we get the fiscal note. However, if it's the will of the body, I'm not opposed to moving it.
And we are competing this morning with the Department of Public Safety and their budget closeout up in Finance Committee, so they're giving the budget Finance Committee a priority over this committee, which I don't understand, but that's the way it is. With your concurrence, Representative Sanders, we'll hold the HB 480 in committee and bring it up again next week under unfinished business. Is there further comments from the committee? Debate? Is there further business to come before the House State Affairs Committee today? Is there any further witnesses on the teleconference that would like to testify or perhaps to add some testimony to their previous remarks? Hearing none, the House State Affairs Committee will stand adjourned at 9:28.